Good morning. So last time we went over some logistics and we started on a little bit of content that was some mix of review and getting into our new material for this course. So one thing we talked about is, well, we're going to be building processors, talking about how processors are designed. Like, what does a processor actually do versus other components of a computer? And we had this model of a processor that was responsible for computation and had to be connected to our storage. Our primary storage was the memory, which we learned we would abstract as this sort of array of bytes. And the processor needed to communicate with the memory, so we said we'd have this, what we call a bus, some communication line, where the processor could request to read or write some part of that array of bytes. And the computers we're used to, the processor can request both machine code to read or data, and the memory doesn't actually know the difference. It just knows the processor wants the thing at this address, and the processor is responsible for figuring out how it's going to interpret that. We also mentioned that, well, we need to do I/O. And one way we can make I/O work is by using the same memory bus model, but have this thing we called an I/O bridge, which is going to just say some of the addresses, rather than actually writing a memory location, we'll just talk to a keyboard or something like that. Then we did some theoretically review, but I know from experience that people's memory grasp of endianness from 2150 is vague at best. So we talked about endianness and little endianness, which is what we're going to have as the default for this entire semester, where the least significant part of a value has the lowest address. So endianness only really matters when we have addresses for parts of a value. And this happens in memory because memory is an array of bytes, and we want to extract things that aren't just bytes from memory. We want to extract 4-byte integers or other larger values, and we need to decide which part of the value has the lowest address or the highest address. For things like registers, like RAX, we don't have to worry about endianness because there's not a way of saying, you know, part one of RAX. That's just not a thing that exists. So we don't have to worry about little or big endianness because we just don't have numbers for the parts. We don't have to decide how the parts actually combine. And we started talking about assembly syntax. We mentioned, because of what our textbook does and the defaults for tools on Linux, we're going to be using AT&T syntax. So we talked about how that differs from the Intel syntax you may remember. And the big things we discovered is that the destination of instructions is last in AT&T syntax. And we have a dollar sign before constants, a percent before registers, unlike Intel syntax where they were just unadorned. And we have this special syntax for accessing memory based on a calculation, where we have these four fields that we fill in this syntax with a field I call the displacement, which is a constant to add, a base register, an index register, and a scale register, and we access memory at an address we compute by taking the displacement plus the value of the base register plus the value of the index register times the scale, which is what sort of is supported in x86-64 instructions. So questions about these things we covered last time? So I'm going to start with a piece of logistics I promised last time, which was demoing our quiz system. So you're going to have a quiz system that will look kind of like this. This is a demo site, so the real site is, the real site is here and looks something like this, but I'm not going to show you the real quizzes questions in advance. because especially since I might change them. So the way taking a quiz works is that you'll choose your quiz. It will ask you if you really want to view it. And you'll have a mix of questions that can be multiple choice like this. When you select an answer, the box around the answer should turn green. If it doesn't, things aren't working. For example, you might have a network problem, there might be a login problem, but if the answer doesn't turn green around after you select an answer, it's not recorded. If it turns green, it is recorded, we have your answer. You don't need to press a submit button or anything. We get it as you put in your answer. There's a place to put comments. So if you think a quiz question is ambiguous, missing information, has an error, this is what that field is for. We will have someone read all the comments and adjust grades accordingly. And of course, if we discover from reading the comments that maybe the question didn't make any sense, we might drop the question or something like that. But the comments field is where you can put all your "this question doesn't make sense" sort of complaints. Generally, I won't be able to answer such questions in advance, partly because, well, if someone takes the quiz, you know, Friday morning and then decides that they now have the rest of the weekend and Monday to work on other things, I don't want to tell them, "Oh, sorry about that. You have to reread the question." Or if you bring up the answer, so if you bring it up later and things like that. So generally, I'm just not going to answer sort of clarifying questions about the quiz while it's out. And we'll just deal with it in grading. And that's what the comments field is for if you think it actually doesn't make sense. So we'll have multiple choice questions like this. There can also be brief free response questions, like what's a number? You have to fill in. I think I have an example, which would look like this. After the quiz is due, you can view the quiz, and you can see how you answered, and also the distribution of student answers. That's what those percentages are, and the correct answers, and for a free response question, a key below it. In the case of a comment, if someone looks at your comment, there may be feedback about why your comment did or did not affect the answer and any adjustment to the score as a result. And this is linked off the main website and Colab from the overview tab. So questions about the quiz system or quiz logistics. Yes?
Would it be a good idea to use the past quizzes as study materials, or has the course changed a lot since?
So the question is, would it be a good idea to use the past quizzes as study materials? So quizzes are open book, open notes, open whatever. They're not timed. So you can decide what study materials make sense for answering the quiz once you see it. In general, I expect past quizzes will be similar. Yeah, and they are posted on the website. That's like more of a general studying material stuff. Other questions? Yes? Question is, do you have to take it all at once? No. You can go back to the quiz anytime before it's due. And we'll just take your last answers. Other questions? Okay. So. And yes.
Does the quiz mainly cover the material from the class, or
the question is, what material does the quiz cover? Generally, the quiz will be primarily the week's lecture material and maybe the week's allotment. Questions, how long? They're usually 4-ish questions. It varies, and some questions, you know, even if it's 4 multiple choice questions, that can be varying amounts of actual work, obviously. Other questions? Okay, so back on the quiz. Okay, so last time when we left off, we were looking at, I believe, this AT&T syntax example. We finished up on this, saw our general syntax for accessing memory, and this is the sort of, well, the most general form we'll learn in this class. There's actually a few other options Intel has that we don't care about. And often we don't need all this stuff, and we want to access memory in a simpler way, so AT&T syntax supports just omitting fields there. So if you omit the index and the scale, you just have displacement and base. You can also omit the displacement and just defaults to 0. If you omit the scale, it defaults to 1, and so on. And probably the only really confusing thing here is that if you omit everything in parentheses, it's just a memory location. And that's why we needed a dollar sign for actual constant, because if it's not a constant, it's a memory access just without using any registers to compute the address. Okay, so questions on these options for finding memory locations. Okay, so I mentioned earlier the rule that the destination is last, and this has a consequence that causes some confusion, which is that this means that for the subtract instruction, which is the same subtract instruction you learn with Intel syntax, the destination is last. So it does the same thing in either case, even though this might not be the subtract operation you were expecting. The way I like remembering this is I think of this comma as representing from. So this is R8 minus REX. Subtract REX from R8 and put the result in R8. And compare does the same thing, which is usually the bigger source of confusion. As we'll learn a bit later, compare is really a subtract instruction that forgets to write a register. Questions about this? Yes. Where would the result be stored? Where would the result be stored for the subtract?
Yeah, for the subtract.
In R8, as this up here is meant to indicate. Other questions? Okay. Yes. So the question is, what would the use of compare? So the example I give here is that if you do this compare, after this, if you use jump greater than, for example, it would jump if R8 is greater. R8 is the value that we're checking conceptually. We'll talk about what's really happening in more detail later. Sorry? So I say if you did this compare instruction, then afterwards JG, which is jump if greater than, would jump if R8 was greater.
I think he's confused about the queue. Because the queue just means quad.
Yeah, sorry. You're asking what's the queue in the comp instruction? That's saying that the things we're comparing are 8 bytes. And it could have been omitted. Sorry, I missed, didn't get your question. Other questions? Can we compare values of different sizes? No. You need to make them the same size first. Yes? Question is, do we need to include a queue or and so on? You do not need to include it if it's unambiguous from the operand. So in these examples, it could have been omitted. Where you would need it is if like the operands are like constants in memory locations, then those could be different sizes you need to specify. Other questions? Okay. And we mentioned, but just to reiterate, that constants have a dollar sign. If you don't have a dollar sign, it's not a syntax error, which is usually what confuses people. And often it's a real instruction that has a very confusing difference. So that's summary of AT&T syntax. Okay. So one other thing that you'll see probably when doing the BombLab and homework if you use AT&T syntax is how jumps work, in particular jumps that are computed, so meaning that they're based on like the value of a register or memory location. And these use a star to represent the in front of the address for the jump, the expression that produces the address, I should say. So jump star RAX, star percent RAX, is read the register REX and set the program counter to that memory location, to that address that's stored in REX. So just take the value of REX, copy it to the program counter. The second example, we're accessing memory. It's a memory location. So we read from that memory location. We don't run machine code there. We're instead reading a pointer from that memory location and storing it in the program counter. And that's where the machine code actually is. So we're reading a pointer to where we actually want to execute code in the second example. Questions? Yeah. Yeah. Question is, the first example means go to the memory address stored in REX? Yes, meaning that REX stores the address of the next piece of machine code we will run. Yes. What does the star mean? I think the logic that the designers of AT&T syntax had in mind is that if I just wrote jump percent RAX, that would mean to like actually execute machine code in RAX. And they want to indicate that there's a level of indirection. Other questions? Yes. Yes, if you go to the website, they are on the schedule page. Okay. Questions, do I post these slides? Yeah, they're on the schedule page along with lecture recordings. Other questions? Yes. The question is, what would happen if I wrote jump queue RAX? That I would expect that to be a syntax error. Jump queue, I guess, at percent RAX would I expect to be a syntax error. Other questions? So that's AT&T syntax. And just as an example to at this. So here's a swap function. So it takes two pointers to longs and swaps the two longs by using the pointers. And I have it written in AT&T syntax. And if you're used to Intel syntax, so you'll note that the destination is a last. So in each of these cases, you know, the writing happens in to the last operand, and the percents indicate that it's a memory access using a register and not accessing just the register. So sort of what we can imagine sort of pseudocode for this looks like so. And if we were simulating this, let's say here we have some values for memory and RDI, RSI, and RSP. You know, we'd execute our first instruction, and this instruction, it says read from the memory location specified by RDI. RDI contains 4000. So we look at memory at 4000, and I've written out memory as a bunch of 8-byte values, even though we know it's really 1-byte values, just for convenience. And we'd say, oh, that's hex 99999, and we copy that into REX from that instruction. And the next instruction would do the same with RSI and RDX. Questions about how you would know that this happened? This is how we read this instruction? Yes?
What's the difference between the parentheses in the first term versus the second?
The question is, what's the difference if you put the parentheses in the first term or the second? So in AT&T syntax, the destination is the always the last operand. And if we have no parentheses, it just means accessing the register directly. If we have parentheses, it means that we're using the register as part of some sort of memory address calculation. So as we'll see in this example, because we don't have parentheses around RDX, the value of RDX actually is what's moved. And because we have parentheses around RDI, it's used to determine where in memory to operate on. Does that answer that question? Other questions? Yes.
So in the first move statement, if there wasn't parentheses around the RDI, would it put 0x04000 in to RDX?
Question is, if there was no parentheses around this first statement here, would it copy this value here into REX? Yes. Other questions? Okay. So we incidentally got to this instruction, which moves a value from RDX into that memory location. And our last instruction moves a value from RAX into the memory location specified by RSI. And this ends up doing the swap operation to the two things pointed to by RDI and RSI, which, if you remember, your calling convention is would be the two arguments to a function, the first two. And then we have a return here. Our last operation. Return's gonna read from memory somewhere. Can someone tell me where? RAX, that is not correct. Return. So there's a reason though why you thought it read from RAX, because you're like, oh, the return value is an RAX, but that is not something the return instruction actually cares about. And the reason why it doesn't care about it is because, well, to actually go back from a function, we don't need to do anything with the return value except not change it. So the return instruction doesn't do anything with the return value, it just leaves it untouched so it can be used later. But what it does need to do is it needs to figure out where to jump to. So where does that information come from?
The stack.
And we would know where the stack is from the stack pointer. So our return instruction is going to use that stack pointer to figure out where to jump to. Other questions? Yes. So the question is, how does the return instruction change the stack pointer? And it will add on 64-bit x86 8 to it to remove the value, the return address, the place to return to from the stack. Other question?
Are you allowed to edit the stack?
Question is, are you allowed to edit the stack? Absolutely. Obviously, this code doesn't, except for changing the stack pointer with return, but it's a memory location you can access using these move instructions like this. Other questions? Yes.
So REX is like untouched by the return statement?
Question is, REX is untouched by the return statement? Yes. So it just has the same value it used to have. So this function probably doesn't actually have a return value, right? Because you wouldn't declare a swap function returning something. But if you look at what it does to REX, well, it set REX to a value, and when this return jumps to wherever swap was called, REX is still going to have that value. So if it wanted to return that value, it's still going to be there for whoever called swap to use it. Other questions? Okay, so that's our review of AT&T syntax, and also incidentally preview of calling convention stuff. So there's some things about how x86 64 assembly works that you probably either didn't go over in 2150 or didn't go over in a way that you actually remembered. One of these that I think you just didn't go over is some details of how the overlapping registers work. So you probably remember that we have these 64-bit registers like RAX, RCX, RBX, RDX, RDI, and so on. And we also have these smaller registers like EAX or AX or AL, which are just parts of those bigger registers. So EAX is a name for the least significant 32 bits of REX. AX is a name for the least significant 16 bits. And AL is a name for the least significant 8 bits. And these sub-registers exist for all 16 of the base 64-bit registers. And I have this table with the names because, no, I don't expect you to memorize that it's DIL, but AL. You know, there's like three different variations, and R8B. So you can look them up here. And as a special case, RAX, RCX, RBX, and RDX have a name for the bits 8 through 16, so the second least significant 8 bits that doesn't exist for all the other registers. And in x86 assembly, you can use these smaller registers, you know, or the bigger ones, and it seems like most of the instructions work with all the versions. There's some exceptions, like you can't use the smaller registers for addresses generally, which makes sense because addresses are too big. But there are some special rules about how it works when you use some of these smaller registers combined and then later use one of the bigger registers. So it would look like from this diagram that if you write a value to EAX, it doesn't change any other part of REX, right? The top 32 bits, the most significant 32 bits of REX look like they should be unchanged. And that's not how it works. There's a special rule that whenever we write to a 32-bit register, it clears the upper bits of the corresponding 64-bit register. That's just a special rule that was made when they went from 32 to 64 bits. So you look at this and say, okay, so that means if I write to, say, AL, the bottom 8 bits of this, the same thing should happen, right? No. Sorry. Basically, when they were going from 32 to 64 bits, they said, oh, it would be convenient to clear the rest of the register. When they were going from 8 to 16 to 32, they didn't make this decision. And I'm mentioning this primarily because when you do the bomb lab and homework, you're going to see the assembly the compiler generates. And the compiler often will do things like set EAX to clear RAX. And I want you to understand why that works, why that's not an error, not a bug. If you see the compiler, you know, setting EAX to 0 in order to make the return the value of REX 0. That, in fact, is well-defined to work and not the compiler messing up a corner case. So questions about this special rule about the overlapping register pieces? Yes?
That's supposed to be faster than just setting REX to 0.
So the question is the compiler setting the 32-bit register instead of the 64-bit one because it's supposed to be faster? It's faster in the sense that the machine code's a little shorter, and that's probably why the compiler's doing it. It's probably not faster other than the consequences of the machine code being a little shorter and therefore a little easier to get from memory. Other questions? Yes. Why you can't address
the smaller?
What do you mean address? You can't use them to make addresses. So what I meant by that is that if you wanted to write, you can write move RAX as an address to somewhere, right? But you cannot write move EAX as an address to somewhere. This just isn't allowed. And that's an example of where you can only use one of the types of registers in an instruction. Other questions? Yes?
Does the address of the register depend on the endianess of
the does the
address of the register?
This question, does the address of the register, so registers don't have addresses. So does the address that it points to depend on the endianess of the machine? So the values in registers don't have endianness, because we don't have names, we don't divide them into parts which have addresses. So if you looked at how we divided up the registers here, the way this is defined is that this is the least significant part here and the most significant part on the other side. We don't have a way of saying part 0, 1, 2, 3, so we don't have to deal with endianness. So there's no question of is the register stored in any particular endianness or not. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Is that rule only true for 32 and 64 bits?
Is the rule about overwriting the whole register? Yes. This is only true for 32 to 64? Yeah. So it's only true for the E registers, basically. All the other ones don't do that, like this example. Other questions? Okay, so another thing that comes up a bunch when you do assembly is labels. And labels represent addresses. So you should think of as a label as being a shorthand in the assembler for typing out the actual memory address of something. And sort of as an example of this, here I have a label which is a string. So string colon says that, you know, we're defining a label which is the address of the thing that's after the colon, which is a string in my assembly code. And when I use it earlier, it's going to be replaced with the address of that string. So let's say this string is at stored at address 1234, this add instruction would then be as if I wrote add 0x1234 to RAX. And the second add instruction would be as if I wrote add $1234 to RAX. It's as if the assembler replaced your label with a number that is where it was stored in memory. And after we do that replacement, the usual rules for is this accessing memory or not apply. So in the second example, we're apparently computing a memory address. And in the first example, we're apparently reading the string as if it were a 8-byte integer. And I would hypothesize if you were writing assembly by hand, you probably wanted the second one to compute an address of some part of the string, not the first, but they're both valid and they both have possibly useful effects. Questions? Labels, yes.
So the string dot ASCII,
yes. So the string colon dot ASCII is, yeah, basically declaring a string. So the string colon just says to the assembler, remember where the next thing is in memory with the name string. And the dot ASCII is a way in assembler of saying, don't put instructions here, just put a string in ASCII with a null terminator, probably with a null terminator. Other questions? Yes?
What does the word label mean? Like, are we labeling something?
Label question is, what does the word label mean? Are we labeling something? Yeah, so you think that the string labels, so the text string labels that actual string there. And we can use that label elsewhere in the code. And it's just a name for, yeah, that construct in assembler. Yes?
How do you declare that label?
The question is, how do you declare that label? As long as you don't want to use it from another file, what I've shown you here is sufficient. If you want to use it from another file, depends on the details of your assembler. This is not defined as part of x86-64, because it can vary between OSs and the like. But usually, if you want it to be used from other files, you do something like .globalString in the assembly file. Yes? Can I explain the difference between adding string and adding dollar sign string? So adding string here, this is as if we wrote this OX, the address of the string there. And if we go back to our examples of memory addressing, if we just write a number, that's accessing memory at that address. So that's what we're telling it to do. If we look at our add dollar sign string example, that's like the first example we went to where we put a dollar sign to represent an actual value as a constant. So we're just adding the number that happens to be a memory address, but we're not actually accessing memory yet. Presumably we'd be doing that like because later on we're going to use RAX as a memory address. Yes? How do you assign a value to the label? So we did it because we had the label colon to declare the thing the label should be the address of. And when our executable is produced, that the label will be assigned the value of that address. Other questions? Yes. So the question is, the line that says string colon dot ASCII, is that saying this string is a label for this? So The .ASCII part is just saying, here are some bytes to put in memory somewhere. So we could have also put instructions there, but we're just putting something in memory. It happens to be data, it could have been code. And the string colon says, make it so I can refer to the location of that with the name string. In this case, it's location of a bunch of bytes, but often, like in our example here, it might be the location of some machine code. So this is another label, but it's a label of the location of this move instruction, which is the bunch of bytes we wanted in memory. Does that answer your question? Yes. If I put instructions in where? So if I put instructions instead of this, would it break the code? The code would still work. It would just do something with different. It has a well-defined effect regardless. And I have instructions there in my assembly, but in the actual executable, that would be the machine code for those instructions. That would be what, if I access memory there, I'd be accessing. Other questions? Okay, so that's on labels. So there's one other thing that we're not going to test on, but might come up in the BOM lab and homework that you'll see, which is the very special pseudo-register RIP. So IP stands for instruction pointer, which is another name for the program counter. And you might see assembly, which does something like use the program counter to compute a memory location. So for example, this move instruction here says move from 500 bytes after the next instruction's address into RAX. And compilers like generating code that uses this because it means that the compiler and the assembler and the linker don't need to worry as much about where the code ends up in memory to access things, you know, data that's embedded with the code. And there's one special case you might see if you look at the assembler output of a compiler, which is that as a very special case, even though it violates the rule I just told you, if you see label %RIP, that basically means the same thing as label, except the address is computed in a different way at runtime. This is a very special case because it doesn't follow the rule about the label being replaced with a number that we went to earlier. Questions about RIP? Okay, so let's do exercise with labels here. So here's a little function which calls putS. putS outputs a string to the terminal. So question is basically, what string does this output? And we start with the string hello world, but we might change it. We might and do something to it. So what goes on here? Yes, I would recommend writing things down, but that's your option. And you can discuss with your neighbors, it's fine. Okay. Who would like some more time? Not seeing volunteers, so you know what? Some people want more time. Yes? No? Okay. Let's see. Here we are. So who thinks A? B? Okay. C? D, E, F, okay, G, H, I, something else, no clue, okay, so we're split between no clue and B and C with a scattering of a few other answers. So I'll go through how I work this. So big thing you need to remember for this is that when we have a dollar sign, that's a constant. When we don't, it's not. So this first move here is moving from a memory location, because there's no dollar sign, it's not a constant. So we're getting a memory location hello plus one. So hello is going to be replaced by whatever the address of that string is in memory. So we're going to store the ASCII for that string in memory somewhere. We're going to get an address of it and add one. Since each byte of the string is one character, adding one to the address is going to give us the address of the second character, which is going to be this E here. So this means that BL contains the character E. So it contains a number, of course, but it's the ASCII for E. And then we subtract one from that, and the way ASCII works, the character that's numerically before E in ASCII is D. So this means that after the subtract instruction, BL becomes D. Remember that the destination's always last year. And the subtract is subtracting the constant one because we do have a dollar sign. And then we move from BL, which now contains D, into the memory location hello. And this is not the memory location we started out with. We didn't add one. So it's hello plus nothing. So it's the location of the character H here. So it's the creation of this H, so we replace this H with a D. Then we take the address of hello. We know it's the constant, the address, because we have a dollar sign, so we're using the address as a number. We're not accessing memory at that address yet. And we put that in RDI, and that's the argument we supply to puts, which makes sense because puts expects a pointer to a string to print out, and that's what we're giving it, and the string is this D Dello world answer B. So questions about how I figured this out, or other things about this exercise? Yes. Excuse me? Hello? Yeah. Sorry, can you? The question is, does each character in the string have its own memory address? Yes. Since they're one byte, those memory addresses are one byte apart. Your question? Sorry, when you move BL... Why did the H get replaced? So how did I determine that the H was replaced and not the E? Is that what you're asking? I determined where the D was going to be written by looking at this move instruction here. And if I look at that move instruction, the address we're computing is the address of the string. And the address of the string is the address of the beginning of the string. So it's the address of the H character. Yes. So question, for this move queue dollar hello, do we need the dollar sign? Is that what you're... Shouldn't the what? Sorry? So isn't the dollar sign in front of a constant? So you're saying hello doesn't seem like a constant? Is that your complaint? Yeah. So the way I would think of labels is that the label is going to be a constant value when the executable is made, right? It doesn't change between different runs of the executable. So it's constant in that sense. So once the instruction runs, it's a constant. Does that answer your question? Yes? So
just sort of expand that a little bit. So in this context, dollar sign hello is kind of creating a pointer to hello. Is that be accurate?
Or not? The question is, does dollar sign hello create a pointer to hello? I would think it represents a pointer to hello. Yes. Question? What would happen without the dollar sign in front of hello? It would have been answer I. It would have been the integer constructed from the ASCII for that string. Because we would have accessed memory where the string is, tried to read it as an 8-byte integer, and put that value in RDI. And puts would probably try to use that as a memory location, and it wouldn't work. Yes, your question?
So my train of thought was that, because you mentioned that labels without the dollar sign point to the value that address.
So the question is, you were thinking labels point to the value that's at the address. So labels are the address themselves. That's the confusion. So they do point to the value at the address, but they are the address.
Oh, I see. So what's the distinction with the dollar sign then?
So the dollar sign means that we're using the address as a number.
Okay. Oh, I see. So
versus without the dollar sign, we're using the address as a way to access memory.
Okay. So it would be accessing the next one more than the value of that.
So the question is, the first move B is accessing the value at the address that's one more than hello. Yeah, yes. Notably, importantly, the address is what we add one to. Yes?
Is it the hello is stored address of the H?
the question is, does hello represent the address of the H? Yes.
And is the address of the H like unique in the machine because it's disabled?
The question is the address of the H unique? It's just in the machine. So the address of the H is decided when we make the executable. Back there? Yes. Yeah. Question is when hello is moved to RDI, it contains the memory address of the string. Yes, that's why I call it a pointer to the string. Yeah, your question.
What does put s do?
What does put s do? Put s outputs a string. It's a function in the C standard library, kind of like printf. If you remember that, or alternately, it's the equivalent of cout in C. Cout in C++ in C. Your question? So the question is, could have BL have been replaced by a different register like RDX? So if I replaced BL with RDX here, I would get an error from my assembler saying, sorry, I can't move a byte into a big register like RDX. But you could have replaced it with any of the other small register, 8-byte registers, 8-bit registers, rather, sorry. So follow-ups, other questions? Oh, oops. Yeah. So the question is, could I have used a larger register if I changed the type of the move to not move a byte? Yes, but that would have a different result, because we'd also be writing more than one byte in the last move B, if we changed that to a move W or something like that. Okay, back there.
So for the first move instruction, what would be moved into BL if it was $hello+1?
Question is, what would be moved into BL if it was $hello+1? I would hope the assembler would complain that that value's too big. Otherwise, I assume it would be the address. It would compute the address of $hello+1 and give you the bottom 8 bits of it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. What is the oh, so I'm giving you, I'm saying the prototype of put s is that its first argument is a const char star, and I'm calling that argument s. And then I have, as a note in brackets after it, that argument will be stored in RDI. This is just sort of telling you, it's a comment, this is not part of the assembly. This is just trying to tell you how this corresponds to C code. Yes. So if it was move Q instead of move B, would more registers be put into destination? Yeah. So we'd have the ASCII represented as a single number for a more than one character. Yeah.
If the RDI is storing a polymorph string, why would you declare a different character?
If RDI is storing a hello world string, why are we declaring it as a character? You mean in this argument for put us?
Yeah.
So this is not, so this piece of C code here declares S as a pointer to a character, which is, I believe, an accurate description of what RDI is intended to contain. Does that answer your question? Feel like it?
Does RDI just store the pointer of the first character of the string?
The question is, RDI just store the pointer to the first character? Yes. And the way put s works is it looks at the following characters until it finds a null terminating character. I think there's a question over here. We all set? Okay. I I remember why I thought I could cover so little during my schedule. Okay. Does that take so long? Okay, so one other piece of assembly that I believe was covered in 2150, but most people never understood really well, is LEA. So LEA is an instruction, load effective address. And LEA confuses people because it looks like it accesses memory, but it doesn't. So basically what LEA does is we do what we would do to prepare for a memory access, but rather than accessing memory, we just stuff the address we'd use to access memory somewhere. So for example, if we remember our syntax, this here represents memory at the address of 4 plus RAX. And the LEA instruction just says, okay, I computed the address, 4 plus RAX. I'm not going to bother accessing memory. I'm just going to stuff that in my destination register, which here is RAX. So this is equivalent to adding 4 to RAX. Doesn't actually use memory at all. So one way you can think of it, which may or may not help, is you can kind of think of it like it's like the address of operator for memory access in assembly. Like the instruction is the address of operator. We compute an address, but we don't actually access memory there. We just put the address in the destination. And we say, why would this instruction be something we want to supply? So one reason is because, well, often we need to compute actual addresses. So it's really handy to have a way of doing that. That's the same as how we actually move things from addresses. So that's why the assembly designers wanted that. Another reason is that, well, we have this way of computing addresses, which actually can do some useful math. So it would be good to supply a way of getting at that, because the processor is implementing, you know, that base plus index times scale math in a very efficient way anyways. Let's make it so the compiler can use that for math in addition to accessing memory. So questions? Yes. Question is, you read that this doesn't do you set flags? Yes, we will talk about that when we get to what flags are and why they matter. Yeah.
So if RAX plus 4 in this instance, or like the address of memory RAX plus 4 contained an integer and you use the LEA instruction, would RAX plus 4 now contain that integer instead of containing like the address?
So the question is, if RAX plus 4 contain an integer instead of an address, is that what you're saying? So
RAX plus 4, if RAX plus 4 initially contain the address of an integer.
Okay, so if RAX plus 4 contain the address of something, so this instruction doesn't access memory, so it doesn't actually care what is in memory, which means that it's going to compute a number that you could interpret as an address, but because it's not actually accessing memory, it doesn't care whether it's a real address or not. So it's going to add 4 to RAX. That could be a memory address, or it could be just a number that we're adding 4 to. It's the same computation. It's going to do that computation. It's not going to notice whether or not that's a valid memory address in the process. Yeah. So the question is, this just add the memory address of RAX times 4? So RAX doesn't have a memory address, if that's what you're asking. Sorry, is that your question? The address stored in RAX plus 4. So this, adds 4 to the address stored in RAX. Yes, that would be an accurate description. I would just say it adds 4 to RAX, because as we'll talk about a little more, the LEA instruction, since it doesn't access memory, it's often used for things that aren't addresses, right? So the question is that this is the same instruction as add Q$4 RAX? Yeah, so it has It's almost the same effect as add Q for Rx. And when we talk about flags, which someone mentioned, we'll talk about why it's very slightly different, but it's almost the same as that add Q for Rx instruction. Yes? Question, if I was using this for arithmetic, could REX store values rather than like real addresses? Absolutely. And you will find compilers do this all the time. And so I have some examples of things you will see compilers do because these are more convenient than the normal arithmetic instruction. So for example, if you want to multiply a value times 5, this LEA instruction is faster than the multiply by 5 instruction most of the time. And that's often what you'll see compilers generate for if you just write a function which is x times 5. They'll generate that LEA instruction because it's a fast way of doing it. And it doesn't matter if x represents a memory address or not. It's the same computation. That's all the instruction does. And the second example is that we can do this add of two values in one instruction into a third register without a move. Whereas if you wanted to use the normal add instruction, you need to move and then add. Yes?
What is the memory corresponding to that that didn't exist?
So the question is, what if the memory corresponding to the results of these operations didn't exist? It doesn't matter. Because LEA doesn't try to access memory, it won't care. Yes? So the question is the primary use case of LEA doing tricks to make arithmetic faster? I would say that that is not. I think most of the time you'll see it actually used to compute addresses, but it's also used for this probably a minority of the time. Other questions? Okay, since we went over that, what's this function? And LEAL is LEA with a 32-bit result. You might say, that doesn't make sense as an address. And well, it doesn't, but it's allowed. It just takes the 64-bit address, which might not be a real address we computed, and gives you the bottom 32 bits only. But by bottom, I mean least significant. And, oh, I should mention, by the calling convention, the argument arg is going to be an RDI. Okay. I'm going to call a little early so I can try to explain this before lecture ends. So who thinks A, B, C, D, okay, E, F, no clue, or something else, or no clue? Yeah, so some mix with D being the most popular. So the way I figure this out, we have EAX here is RDI times 8, which is the same as ARG times 8. And then EAX, which again is ARG times 8, we subtract EDI from it, ARG. So ARG times 8 minus ARG, because remember it's subtract from. That was the order in AT&T syntax of the subtract instruction, because the destination is always on the right. So this is ARG times 8 minus ARG, which is going to be the same thing as ARG times 7. So it's none of these. It's ARG times 7, which is very similar to D, but not negated. That's where I'll finish up today. Questions? Yes. Question is, why is EDI the same as RDI? So if you remember our overlapping registers, EDI is the bottom 32 bits here of RDI.
So like EDI is the 32-bit, or like the least significant 32 bits of RDI, right?
EDI is the least significant 32 bits of RDI, yes.
Okay. But in this case, they are basically just the same thing.
And in this case, the argument is an int.
Okay.
So it's 32 bits on our systems.
Okay.
So only the bottom 32 bits are used, and the upper 32 bits are going to be zeros.
Okay. So they're interchangeable if it's an int?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.